This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning. Welcome to the Business Hour. I'm Ron Camacho, your host. And today, the business at hand is to get an insider view of an industry segment that exists in more than one region in the U.S. Most people are familiar with the film and entertainment industry that is focused around Los Angeles and New York. But I'm very pleased to have as my guest Rick Reitz, who's an accomplished film, stage, writer, director, composer, and producer of a film. And of equal significance, he has been very instrumental in promoting the entertainment industry here in the Southeast, specifically the state of Georgia. He has created Georgia Entertainment Credits, which we'll be talking about. It's an organization dedicated to supporting the industry by advocating for public policy and tax regulation that allows production companies to get a financial boost. And we're going to talk about how Rick has been involved in supporting this billion-dollar-a-year industry in the state of Georgia, but also we're going to be talking about Rick himself because he's got a really solid background as a professional show business guy. Welcome to the Business Hour, Rick.
Thank you very much, Ron. Great to be here.
Now, we can go, as I alluded to, in a lot of different directions just because you've done a lot of different things personally, professionally, as a show business person, but also you've done a lot of things to promote the film industry in Georgia. And what I'm thinking is that we're going to set things up by going back, being a little more chronological than we might otherwise be, because a lot of times on this program we'll talk about what's going on today in a given industry or in someone's career, and then at some point in time go back. But I really want to start off in this case by going way, way back. As an actor whose career spans over 35 years, including recent performances in Safe Haven, the movie which was filmed in and around Southport in North Carolina, your police chief Mulligan, the Drop Dead Diva TV series, the last of the Robin Hood movie, where you played Melvin Belli.
Yeah, the King of Torts.
And the TV movie Christmas in Conway, which was also a local production. And we can talk about any of those, but I want to go back, because a lot of listeners are very fascinated with how anyone got to where they are professionally, whether it was a direct route, a conventional route, a circuitous route, whatever it was. When did you first think that you could be an actor, a writer, a composer, a producer, which I assume came after acting? But tell us a little bit about how it unfolded and those very earliest stages.
Wow. It's been a long journey. It's been an interesting journey. And luckily enough, grew up in a family that was very artistic and encouraged those endeavors. I came from Rochester, New York, originally, and for those who don't know, that's Western New York, about 6 hours from New York City. But my dad sang, did plays. My mother's a music teacher. My older sister is a modern dancer. She used to be Twyla Tharp's original partner.
Wow.
Way back when Twyla was getting started, and then the two of them sort of split and went different directions. My brother was in bands. My younger brother is now a writer, director, a lot of things of that nature. But I got kicked off in the industry at age 11 by doing some summer stock with my dad and touring and doing some musicals. Although that was not my principal focus growing up and through those years, I wanted to be a baseball player and pursued athletics right into first year college at Bowling Green State University, Ohio, and lost my scholarship when I got a rotator cuff injury on my right shoulder, throwing shoulder. And so I had to sort of rediscover a direction. And so I changed my major to radio, television, film production, theater as a minor, and marketing and business as a second minor, and sort of evolved that way. And I thought, well, maybe I'll be into broadcasting like you. maybe I'll do some sports, maybe I'll do some other things that sort of pique my interest. And when I was 21 years old, I probably looked like I was 15, and my voice hadn't settled in at that time, so I couldn't get employed, whether I'd studied it or not. And I went back to New York and didn't know what to do, and auditioned for a repertory theater company, just more or less on a whim. I had nothing else to do. And I'll be darned if they didn't put me in it. And so I spent the next 3 years in repertory, really learning the art and the craft. And then more summer stock, and then matriculated to New York City, and got my feet wet there. And things just started to gel and happen. You know, you start to showcase, you start to do programs. I remember doing theater in Long Island and off Broadway and dinner theater tours back when there were dinner theaters. And music was always an influence because growing up in Rochester, I was near University of Rochester, Eastman School of Music, much like Juilliard. So music influence sort of came along with the territory. And next thing you know, you're doing reviews and showcases, like I said, and I started writing them. I started adding to the body of the work. And eventually I picked up some part-time work at ABC New York, Good Morning America, working on the morning show, just staff, because I had a degree, I needed some money. And the opportunity arose to be in Atlanta, because at that point, well before there was a Weather Channel, well before there was anything else, there was a weather guy who worked on Good Morning America by the name of John Coleman out of WLS Chicago. And he had this dream of starting the Weather Channel in Atlanta because Ted Turner was here. I happened to be in Atlanta when that happened. And I came along and said, all right, I'll be a floor manager, then an associate director, then a director, then a producer. And all these things started to roll forward. And I think the most interesting thing about my life is, you said, circuitous route, is that I didn't know where I was going. I didn't have a game plan. And every time somebody offered me an opportunity, my first response was, and that pays how much? And it was usually more than I was already making. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, I'll do that. And next thing you knew, I was, you know, producing for the Weather Channel. I was producing for WSB Radio, which is a 50,000-watt giant of the South at the time. And we had the number one morning show. I started writing comic bits. I started doing evening improv, like a Second City scenario. Next thing you know, I'm producing and writing, and I'm acting in the troupe. Next thing you know, I'm leaving WSB, and now I'm a full-time actor. And you start to pick up on different things throughout your life, and it was pretty fascinating.
Now, let me ask if growing up in Rochester, I was sort of waiting to ask this question. My impression is that Rochester is somewhat in a league of its own as far as, pardon the expression, Rust Belt cities. You know, it's undergone its own fluctuations in the economy.
Sure.
But I always had this sense, not from visiting because I've never been to Rochester, that there was a critical mass of culture. And whether that was
absolutely.
The Eastman
family. Yeah, that's the Eastman influence.
But also there's a Sunny Rochester. There's the University of Rochester. There's RIT, the Rochester Institute of Technology.
Which is more of a graphics university internationally when you get into the graphic arts. So it was an interesting confluence of energies that sort of happened. And George Eastman himself really kick-started it. People don't realize that Rochester once upon a time had a boardwalk along the lake, Lake Ontario, much like New Jersey. It had a real explosion and growth of culture.
It was a premier destination.
It was
well,
a
right?
premier destination at the time. You know, and what used to be the Western New York or Chautauqua circuit was very influential in the arts. People who toured, you get heard of the Borscht Belt, you know, for the comedians and people like that and entertainers close to New York. But it flushed out across the state of New York pretty well. And it became part of the center of culture because they had the money from the Eastman Company. And George was influential that way. But he also suppressed it, interestingly enough, that he wanted it to be a family town. So eventually, the business he fostered, he ended up chasing away to a large account. Very interesting.
He could have been the Walt Disney of...
He really could have. You know, because remember the influence. I mean, Kodak was a chemical company, and it developed film, and in the nation stages of development of the film industry, the 20s and 30s, I mean, these guys were major contributors. And so a lot of the stars, silent era stars, used to actually live in Rochester or create a second home in Rochester. And so it was not out of the ordinary to walk down the street and see Gloria Swanson. And you go, oh, my God. Or Mary Pickford. Or Douglas Fairbanks Jr. And you're going, what are these people doing here? Well, George Eastman.
Right. I mean, he was in some sense like a Walt Disney, you know, captain of industry who was involved in a segment of the industry that was directly related to film and entertainment.
Absolutely.
Take us back again. You mentioned coming to Atlanta. Atlanta operates in the shadow of New York and Los Angeles, and to some extent, film production-wise, you've had areas like Toronto and Vancouver that that have cultivated movie production more than other areas of entertainment, but a movie production, film production industry. How did it come to be that you would come here and stay here and not get pulled back to any one of those spheres, and what relationship, if any, do you maintain? Because I would imagine you maintain a arm's distance from one or more of those environments.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, growing up in New York and lived for a time, and I still live in Los Angeles. So I actually call New York, Los Angeles, and Atlanta home right now. But you're right about the development of Canada. Interestingly enough, when I transferred, or my wife was transferred, and other business opportunities brought me to Atlanta, which would have been in the early 80s, I was right on the front edge of the development of Atlanta's production culture. Ted Turner, of course, and the explosion of CNN and the Turner Studios, what all that's become, was really growing in the early 80s, and I happened to walk through the door at that time. I actually was about to work with Bonnie and Terry Turner, who went off to Saturday Night Live. We used to work with Jan Hooks and a guy by the name of Bill Tush. They had a show. They had a variety show on little old TBS.
Where are Jan Hooks and Bill Tush?
Bill Tush is now probably close to retirement and out of the business. Jan Hooks was part of a group called Wits End Productions. Wits End Players started with Dick Van Dyke and a guy by the name of Phil Erickson, who were comedy partners in the 50s and worked in radio in the South before Dick moved off to New York and did Bye Bye Birdie and that sort of thing. Phil stayed here and started the Wits End Players. Within that core of the Wits End Players became five or six significant people who went on to major career industries. But getting back to the main part of your question is, early 80s, mid 80s, Atlanta started to turn. And believe it or not, from about 1985 to about 1993-94, Atlanta was the third leading production center for television and film in America after Los Angeles and New York. Because of cost of living, Hartsfield International Airport had begun, access to the culture, diverse topography, etc., started to accelerate production here. And, of course, Ted Turner's presence didn't hurt.
He would be probably the single individual that we might point to that gave communications and entertainment a shot in the arm.
Absolutely, because he took it to a new level, being a superstation. You know, between WGN Chicago and TBS Atlanta, you had two national superstation giants. And basically, he was a marketing individual that was looking for a way to sell more ad time. And by having a national ad network, he discovered he could sell the same minute of advertising twice, regionally, and nationally. So he's a bit of a maverick in many senses, but that's how it took off.
Well, it's a crude analogy, but in some sense he was our George Eastman or Walt Disney.
Sure he was.
I mean, you know, he was the single individual that really boosted the industry.
But you'd ask about Canada. Canada started to flush out specifically Toronto and Vancouver right about the mid-90s to the early millennium. And we can talk more about that in just a second.
Yeah, let's talk more about that. We're going to take a break. We're here with Rick Reitz, who is a Renaissance actor, writer, director, composer, producer, and we're going to be back with Rick to hear more about his career and the industry right after this break.
Come on. Follow Sniffles to Atlanta's go-to center for breathing easy. Do you suffer from chronic sinus headaches, recurrent sinusitis, facial pain or pressure, and chronic congestion? Well, balloon sinuplasty just could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
FollowSniffles.com. We treat the problem, not the symptom. Chronic sinus symptoms, gone. This could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
This proven in-office procedure can have you breathing easy, back to work the next day, and it's done under local anesthesia. Get lasting relief, a quick recovery, and start breathing easy again.
Follow me and breathe easy.
FollowSniffles.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Today's consumers find themselves faced with a greater variety of choices than ever before, both in the food they eat and the information they receive about that food. Feedstuffs Food Link was created to provide you with a balanced source of information for making decisions about your family's balanced diet. Visit FeedstuffsFoodLink.com to learn about your food directly from the source, the people who work every day to provide it. FeedstuffsFoodLink.com, connecting farm to fork.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Business Hour. We're here with Rick Reitz, a Atlanta-based, but with ties to New York and Los Angeles, actor, director, producer, composer, writer, who has been very active in promoting the film industry here in the state of Georgia and in the Southeast. And before the break, we were talking about two other major markets in Canada, Vancouver and Toronto, and having been involved in the promotion of the industry here, Rick, you're very knowledgeable about what's gone on in some of these other markets. Tell us a little bit about what went on with the development of the film industry in Canada, specifically Vancouver and Toronto.
Okay. You have to study the history of this industry to be able to have some sort of sense of where the industry is going. But we just briefly talked about a nearly 10-year period where Georgia accelerated in production and created an infrastructure base. We began to notice, of course, in 1994, 1995, that the business was heading north to Canada. So the first question that begs to be asked is, why? Well, the exchange of the international dollar, U.S. to Canada, was so despair that there was one point where the dollar was the Canadian dollar was at like 38 cents off the American dollar, 38%. Then the Canadian national government started to infuse the industry with additional incentives, make Canadian content, bring your business here, use 50%, 75% of your crews locally based, and we will give you an extra 10, 15%. Well, by the time you did all the mechanisms and put them all together, Canada was operating at about a 40 to 50% discount off the American dollar. So if I had a $10 million film, I could make it for $5 million in Canada. It might have been inconvenient at a certain point to travel a lot of the crews up there, so you lose a percentage of that. But overall, claiming 35% maybe as a net at the end of the day was incentive enough, inducement enough to send that business northward. And it became an issue. It became such an issue that the Motion Picture Association of America and others would lobby in Washington, D.C. to try to stem the tide of what was then called, and probably still called, runaway production, production taken out of the United States. And that also included the explosion in New Zealand and Australia, the Eastern Bloc countries, as they sort of entered the capitalist marketplace, but with low, low, low wages.
Sure, and a lot of people don't realize that a lot of times when they were looking at something that they thought it might have been an American forest, it was in Czechoslovakia.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah, when you know, you're recreating, you know, period pieces. I mean, you go to the Eastern Bloc, and, you know, you're living back 30 years to begin with at that time. And that's not to put that down. You know, that was the development phase that they had. It became attractive. And this, you know, show business is the last word, business. We happen to put on shows as the business, but at the end of the day is what is the cost, what is the risk, what is the exposure, how do you get it back? And so the business really disappeared from the United States borders from 1995 to almost 2005 because of those influences.
Let me ask you whether or not the production crews and the acting ensembles – was able to take advantage of these savings and benefits that certainly producers accrued and production companies. But did that mean that, that some of the salaries were any better, or some of the, any of the wages for the production teams?
Well, you know, there's if you're familiar with the business, you I know you are, but for the listeners, there are what we call above the line personnel and below the line personnel, and that's really a segregation of crew and support and vendors versus the creative talent pool. So above the line would be directors, producers, the actors, the writers, you know, the people who contribute to the art on camera as opposed to behind the camera. And so I don't know that salaries change so much. I mean, it's a commodity market. Whoever's hot and whatever their value is
well,
constantly
not
changing.
Well, not unlike any industry. You know, the investors mm-hmm. are the ones who accrue the benefits, most typically better profit margins, if you
sure.
will.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And because production requires investment, in many cases, that would attract investors that otherwise felt like cost was out of control in New York and Los Angeles.
Well, they're two of the most expensive cities on the planet.
Absolutely. I mean, people don't think about the residual expenses associated with mm-hmm. with a team, an army of support people beyond the acting ensembles that are living in those cities, mm-hmm. and you're trying to accommodate their cost of living.
That's right.
As you pay them wages to perform a variety of tasks. And, you know, we don't need to remind listeners that if you look at that list of hundreds of people that are in the credits, you know, those people are all supported by, in essence, investors, whether it's a large production studio and company, or you know, a small group of investors. Vancouver versus Toronto. I know they're both experiencing some productions currently, but I really have we gotten to the point where we're overshadowing them significantly?
Well, they're still competitive in their own sense, and they get their volume of business, probably not to the extent that they had during that one 10-year span that we've discussed, much to their consternation. But the United States has exploded back and has fought back, beginning in the early millennium, specifically 2002. People started to ask the question, what would it take to bring the production back to the United States proper? And so, fortunately, at that time, about 2002, 2003, disparity in the exchange of the dollar had been a little more proactive in our own sense. You know, it narrowed in margin. And then states began entering the field with about a 15% discount. And that brought it within a 5 to 10% range. And production, they were getting enough heat in Los Angeles and New York where they decided for 5% they would rather, from a public relations standpoint, keep the business in the U.S. There are other savings and costs associated scenarios that go along with that, of course, not having to travel as long a principal distance, this and that, and also a little bit more flexibility in a shooting schedule annually. You know, if you look at Toronto, Toronto is, you know, up in the snow belt. Not that they get a lot of snow, but climate plays a huge factor in their success, as does Vancouver. Whereas in the southwest or even the southeast, a little more flexibility. We still have four significant seasons here in Georgia, unlike, for instance, the more arid climates of New Mexico and Arizona. So you become competitive in different senses. And then, you know, it's the analytics of cost. And at the end of the day, it's who survives. But the states of Louisiana and New Mexico were the first to establish a statewide incentive program to try to neutralize the difference. That began in 2002. Specific to Georgia, we sort of watched. We knew that that seemed to be the trend, but we're a little more conservative as a state in a political sense. And so we sort of watched it, measured it, to see if it would have any kind of real impact, and it began to.
And when you say we just watched, were you yet involved? Did that come a little bit later? Who was it in the earlier stages that said, hey, we should start to do some things here which promote the industry in some of the same ways that New Mexico and Louisiana are?
Well, when we started to examine it, believe it, in the state of Georgia, we began to organize. In 1995, we knew the ship was starting to sink. And so we had to think about what to do about it. We began a group. I was part of an initial group, although I was not its founder at the time, called the Atlanta Production Partnership. And basically, we were to research and discuss ad hoc what is it that we could do about this. And by 1998, we had incorporated and changed our names to the Georgia Production Partnership and started to, you know, put some foundation under ourselves as far as financially becoming active politically, starting to do our own research and pay for it, so that by 2001, we were active in the state of Georgia to give a sales tax and use exemption at point of sale, which is about all that one could do at about that time, until Louisiana and New Mexico started it in another direction. So I became active and on the board of directors and on certain committees within that group, so that by the year 2002, we were starting to really amp up what we wanted to do. By 2004, we took our first chase at legislation. I'm going to be honest, we didn't know much about it. We didn't know how to go about it. We tried, and we got very close. And we'd had a new governor at that time, Sonny Perdue, who was interested in our business but didn't know enough about it, so we had to educate him. So we lost in 2004. We came back in 2005, and this time we won. At the time, the competitive rate for tax incentives for entertainment production was about 15%. So if you had a $10 million movie, you might get a $1.5 million incentive to produce here, a discount, more or less. Then the other states started to amp up their programs, and suddenly they jumped to 25 and 30%, and we had an issue. We spiked briefly in 2005, 2006, but certainly by 2007 we were at the bottom of the heap again, so we had to change our program. And this time we had to do a more comprehensive national study. We wrote a business plan. We're probably the only business plan in the state, much less the nation, that's laid out a 10, 12-year schedule on what we hope to do with the industry. And that's what the governor wanted. And I have to respect the governor at that time because he was a businessman. It didn't matter really what party he was in. What was more important was he says, I don't spend a dollar to make 98 cents. Show me a plan and a program that shows how you can turn that tide over a period of time, and I'll consider it. So by 2007, we did the study. We wrote the business plan through the year 2020 and presented it to the governor, who liked it. It included a number of elements, not just return on investment from a tax basis, a broadened tax base, but we started to add a promotional element, branding, advertising, and marketing element for the state that could be carried by the industry worldwide. And that started to have an in-kind value that was returning at 5-to-1, 10-to-1 over a period of time. And suddenly we were breaking even, at least in that logistical sense. And
but with other implications even beyond breaking even, just the residual impact of jobs.
Well, it's like any kind of stimulus in an economy. You find a catalyst that creates an industry, that expands it like a ripple effect, like throwing a rock, a pebble in water, and watching it expand outward. And suddenly infrastructure growth that is non-incentivized, and now we've got an ecosystem that's developed broadly over a period of time. And we got that legislation passed in 2008. We went from a pre-2007 numbers of a gross economic impact of about $200 million. We're closing in on $3.5 billion in 5 years.
And we're going to be talking about some of the specific GWIS numbers associated with the industry when we come back, but we're going to take a break. We're here with Rick Wright, actor, writer, composer, director, producer, and we're talking about the industry here in the Southeast focused on Georgia. We'll be back with Rick to talk more right after this break.
The United States Justice Foundation, since 1979, has been dedicated to instructing, informing, and educating the public on legal issues confronting America. That means you and me. When necessary, this nonprofit organization has had to litigate to present the constitutional view. Since 1980, USJF has submitted testimony to the U.S. Senate on all but one U.S. Supreme Court nominee. Learn more about USJF by visiting their website at www.usjf.net. support this nonprofit as it defends our rights, our liberty, and our Constitution.
Did you miss the show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options, such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle, medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Business Hour. I'm Ron Camacho, your host, and we've been talking with Rick Reitz about the entertainment industry, primarily focused on the film industry and primarily focused on the state of Georgia, but we're talking about the region as well. And in fact, during the break, I was asking Rick whether we were currently in the number three position, and Rick pointed out that to some extent we share the third to fourth position with Louisiana. Rick, let's talk about the dollars, and then I want to touch on the number of productions, which is really very significant. People aren't aware of just the sheer number of productions in Georgia and in the Southeast, and the number of people within the industry that are employed. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about those the gross economic impact and the economic implications of an industry that goes beyond that $3.5 billion.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And once again, I didn't have the background or training to analyze these sort of things in the beginning, but you learn over time. And I enjoy flexing my wings and trying to figure out how other industries work. I mean, I'm always interested in business globally anyway. But let's talk functionally about dollars again. We started before the break talking about pre-2008 legislative change, where there's approximately a $200 million gross economic impact, which in 5 years has grown to $3.35 billion to be exact right now, $3.5 billion gross economic impact. The numbers for fiscal 13 for the state of Georgia I'm citing in comparison with those of fiscal 2007. So pre-incentive, 5 years into the incentive plan. We have to first distinguish direct investment into the market. Whenever you do economic forecasting and you use a plan, the national government, states pretty much throughout the U.S. use a scenario called the IMPLAN, I-M-P-L-A-N, IMPLAN Pro 2 number 2 model, where they use really information gathered over 50-year periods so they can start to see trends, mark them, and be able to successfully project numbers. So using that plan, the key to this whole business is return on investment, like any business. So basically, once again, using $200 million in gross economic impact, that doesn't actually reflect the dollars invested to the market, direct dollars invested to the market. Within the IMPLAN model, they come up with multiplier factors. How many times does a dollar turn in the market? One time? Five times? 10 times? To give you perspective, the manufacturing community, based on social infrastructure and all other global factors, they generally turn about two times in the marketplace. Using as another barometer, people who are on tourism and trade, when you get a Super Bowl, when you get an All-Star game, when you get the SEC Championship game or the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl or something of that nature, these numbers are reflected at conventions. They're reflected at a multiplier of 7. So that dollar turns over 7 times. The reason being why it's different from manufacturing is these people don't live here. They come in, they drop their money, and they go. The entertainment industry is somewhere in between. A lot of the business comes to the state, drops the money, and leaves. Others, and our infrastructure is growing, a lot of them are now starting to stay. So we have more or less come to a place in our history where we use an approximate 3.5 multiplier. So applying that back once again in 2007, you know, divide $200 million by 3.5, and that will be your gross investment in the market. Our gross investment in the market is just shy of $1 billion in fiscal 13. So times 3.5, that's why the numbers are just shy of 3.5 billion as a gross economic impact. Why is that number significant? That number is significant because that becomes a broadened taxable base over a period of time. So you say, well, we collect 4 cents on the dollar for a sales tax or 6% here for personal income tax. And you go, based on $1 billion? You go, no. We collect that money based on $3.5 billion.
Let me also ask you this question, Rick. You alluded to, you actually said flat out that with some productions, you know, you have a Super Bowl that comes to town, and it's definitely an economic generator. But everyone associated with the production, or at least the vast majority, are folks who are coming to town and then leaving. And am I mistaken? Versus some production markets that are vying with New York and Los Angeles, like Vancouver and Toronto, you know, when we talk about the multiple layers of mm-hmm. benefits, one of them is that we have this educated, skilled production workforce.
Labor pool, yeah.
That live here, mm-hmm. and they're getting pretty well paid.
Mm-hmm. Very well paid.
Yeah, very well paid. You know, people are always talking about freelancers, but we're talking significant amounts of money, and that money stays here because they live here. And would that be different? Am I correct in assuming that Toronto and Vancouver may have a few thousand, but not the over 25,000 that we're estimated to have?
Well, the thing is it fluctuates. It changes. I would say at its high watermark, Vancouver and Toronto may have influenced as many as 15, 20, 25,000 people in their collective industries. The significant difference in Georgia versus what is now 44 states vying for the attention of the entertainment industry with tax incentives. Let's eliminate New York and L.A. And so take away two of those, a couple of them that are on the edge. So let's call it 40 competitive states. Why Georgia? Once again, we have to look back at our history. From 85 to 95, we were the third largest producer. That created an indigenous infrastructure that more or less stayed. When the business went away, they became gypsies. And they had to do work in Louisiana, or they did it in California or Florida, wherever they happened to go. But they always wanted to come home to do business. So when we kickstarted and got back into our program again in the mid, you know, first decade of the first millennia of the 2000s, so you sort of look at it and go, why are we different from Louisiana? We had the base to begin with. We actually have more physical people, resources, vendors, experienced personnel on the ground here than any of the other competitive states, with the exception of New York, California, and probably Illinois.
So that I don't forget, let's talk a little bit about infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Because don't we have significantly greater infrastructure, again, outside of New York and Los Angeles?
All relative, of course.
Yeah. Our infrastructure is very significant and in a growth mode.
Oh, absolutely so. Let's, once again, we can quote numbers here. In 2004, we might have had 400 people who lived here who were part of a craft union called IATSE, International Association of Theatrical Stage Employees. And you've got the Teamsters. They had a presence. Cinematographer 600, which are part of IATSE but have their own sort of separate identity, and then the Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA. So you had the five major groups, the support craft unions, all working together, but using IATSE numbers, they were at about 400 members. They're over 3,000 now, locally, permanent. Screen Actors Guild, collectively, if I took American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFTRA, and Screen Actors Guild, SAG, which are now one union, by the way, as of last year. But back then, if you're looking at the compiling the data, together they probably did not add up to 800 people locally. Now we're closing in on 2,000 locally. And it's not just people joining. It's people relocating from, oddly enough, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Toronto, Vancouver, London. And we're getting people now from Eastern Europe relocating to this market because there's so much business.
And in sheer number of productions, I don't have a figure for 2013, but in 2012, I understand we had 333 productions. Do you have any idea of what 2013 looks like?
The final numbers aren't in, but I believe, and these are just the incented programs, by the way, those productions. That doesn't actually add up the people who did not qualify. Just to give you a perspective there, the state of Georgia, by statute, a production to qualify, either single or aggregated over a year's time, has to meet a minimum threshold of $500,000 in direct investment in the business. And that has to be qualified, quantified. And after that point, some of that business will move on and become the big, big, big stuff. Other stuff just sort of sits on the fringe. We actually probably we have a robust industry, which would include music videos, corporate videos, commercials that don't reach that threshold of several hundred million more in business. So all the incented business is not the total picture. And as infrastructure changes and grows, now you're starting to get vending groups, studio groups. We have now Pinewood Shepperton of London relocating their North American unit to just outside of Atlanta. EUE Screen Gems, which is Wilmington, New York, Atlanta. Riverwood Raleigh Studios. Raleigh Studios is well known nationally. We've got, those are the three main branded studios, but we've got another five, six studios in development with true soundstage production. Of all the other groups outside of New York, Chicago, L.A., the most robust infrastructure growth happens to be here. 70 natural vendor supplier groups in the industry, including groups like Panavision, have relocated to Atlanta.
The growth of our infrastructure, that this might be one of the areas where we actually do, in terms of sheer growth of infrastructure, where we might eclipse New York and Los Angeles, because as far as I know,
I don't know if we can do that. I mean, remember, we're competing against two markets that have 100 years of history. One, New York, even longer than 100 years.
But I'm thinking, have there been a relocation of major studios to those markets that we know of recently? I mean,
I think there are investment dollars in each of those cities, the rehabilitation of sites, but I don't know. Well, I know New York has some new studio development, but Los Angeles, not so much.
Okay. Well, I what I know is that it's been really significant here, and when we come back, we'll be taking a break. But Pinewood Studios alone and EUE.
Pinewood's a game changer here.
Yeah. And let's talk about why it's a game changer. I mean, a lot of people are somewhat familiar with who they are, but most listeners may not be aware of what kinds of productions Pinewood is responsible for. And on the new 288-acre facility.
That's phase one.
Yeah.
That's phase one. There's more.
Unbelievable. We're here with Rick Reitz. We've been talking about the film and entertainment industry in the Southeast, focused on the state of Georgia. And we'll talk a little bit more about the Southeast relative to Georgia when we come back. And, you know, Rick is just a wealth of information. So we'll see you back here in just a couple minutes.
The Business Builders Seminar Series presents cutting-edge business services and products in an academic setting to top executives and business owners. Business Builders features a pool of best practice solution providers to educate, enlighten, and implement solutions. The seminars create more effective and efficient management skills while vastly improving business profitability and success. Business Builders has grown from the initial seminar of about 50 guests to an ongoing program attracting over 100 top executives for each topic. For more information, visit businessbuildersteam.org.
Hi, I'm Paisley McDonald, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my show, At Home with Paisley, every week, Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern, for practical advice and stylish living for your home and office.
Do your children know where their food comes from? At ConnectingFarmToFork.com, there's all kinds of ways to help your child understand how 300 million of us here in America stay nourished, clothed, and healthy. Activities, food facts, and farm visits help young people learn about America's hardworking farmers and have lots of fun doing it. Visit ConnectingFarmToFork.com today for a learning experience that'll really grow on you. ConnectingFarmToFork.com, brought to you by the people who care at Feedstuffs Food Link.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Business Hour. We're here with Rick Reitz, an actor, director, producer, composer, and an advocate for the Georgia film and entertainment industry. And we've been talking about that industry with Rick and talking about his role in helping to create a climate that attracts production companies and studios. And just before the break, we were talking about infrastructure and the growth of infrastructure. And it's really very, very significant if Atlanta and the Georgia region is to become the third largest site for film and entertainment. Part of it will be boosted by very recent increases in the building of sound stages. And we mentioned Pinewood Studios, for example. I said 288 acres, which is a big facility, and you said that's just phase one.
Correct.
Rick, help listeners understand what the real importance of a venerable studio like Pinewood means.
Well, for those who don't know about Pinewood Shepperton, the two great studios of London that brought you the James Bond movies, the Harry Potter movies, and boy, a host of so many, internationally known. I mean, they have operations in Malaysia and around the world, but no North American presence. So bringing an international brand like that to the United States is very important. The fact that they selected Atlanta over other southeastern states or even other states with tax incentives for productions is significant. But there are reasons for that. Let's look at what is most fertile ground for the development of industry outside of New York, Los Angeles, Chicago. And you start to look regionally at an area that has access. Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport is one of the key reasons. You can get anywhere from in the world to Atlanta direct. And because there are competitive statuses of all the airlines, you can get here inexpensively. It is far more expensive to get to Wilmington, North Carolina, to get to New Orleans, Louisiana, to get to even Orlando, Florida, or any of the other competitive states, Santa Fe, New Mexico, Albuquerque, New Mexico. Well, that's close to Los Angeles area. From an international community, we become the one with the most easy access, and that has cost associated with it. Another thing we have is I think I mentioned we have four distinct seasons, so we can play that, but we have a very short winter schedule, but you can play that. You know, we have a robust spring and fall. We have a diverse topography that goes from the Gold Coast of Georgia to the Okefenokee Swamp to major metropolitan areas that are quite contemporary, to rural areas, to the North Georgia Mountains. I mean, our history goes back to doing Deliverance, Northeast Georgia, on a river that seemed to be insignificant at the time, but now, from an economic standpoint, boasts a $30 million a year whitewater rafting industry, which exploded the northeastern corridor of the state. But Pinewood selected that for a number of reasons. Also, you have to think about proximity. It's hard to develop industry in and around or near existing centers of industry. To build it out even in Boston, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, around New York, you're just too close to the center of the storm. Same can be said about the Southwest, is why would you build an industry right close to the hub? So regionally, geographically, Atlanta and Georgia proper are really the most fertile ground for the development of that industry. And then you have other things. You know, the cost of living here is clearly one-third of the cost of New York and Los Angeles. So you've got that going. Quality of life changes here. You and I were discussing that earlier prior to the interview, is why Atlanta? Why not Atlanta? And I don't think that we're so ambitious that we think we can overcome New York and L.A. I have so many great colleagues, and there's such great history and technology and people there. I don't think you can supersede those cultures. And let's really think dynamically, broad range. Los Angeles, for instance, has 70,000 union actors. You heard me say that we're closing in on 2,000. Scale of market, it makes a big deal. That doesn't mean our people are less experienced or less good. They're just fewer of us. And the cream of the crop is probably a percentage like it would be in Los Angeles. There's just a larger and deeper pool
What's that number in like in New York? Do you know?
New York, the union affiliated actors are somewhere probably around 25,000.
You know, we just enumerated factors that make Atlanta and Georgia attractive to production companies and studios. We've been talking about tax incentives, and a lot of people, because they've been made aware recently that we have an advantageous tax structure, might point to it. And then when they hear about some of those tax incentives potentially being withdrawn or actually withdrawn in the state of North Carolina, that really highlights the importance of mm-hmm. tax credits. But we talked about skilled labor. Mm-hmm. We've talked about infrastructure. We've talked about our climate, the topography, which is important because if you want film something that looks like it's in another part of the world, a varied typography is important. We actually have enough diversity urban-wise that you mm-hmm. can film something here and have it look like it's New York or L.A. if it's done right.
Sure. Even Las Vegas.
Or Las Vegas. Our settings, again, urban, big towns, small towns, rural settings. The airport is really, really big. Mm-hmm. The cost of living, the cost of land, certainly Pinewood studios would have thought.
The best value for their dollar is right. Really here. And keep in mind that the English pound and the euro still exchange at a higher value than the U.S. dollar. So bringing European production to the United States is an important thing. So if you're here to save money, do you take that production to New York? It's a little bit closer, obviously, but not that much closer. Certainly has the history, but why Atlanta? Once again, it's the bottom line. And when you talk about the bottom line, again, you were talking about the selection of where do Georgia and Louisiana sit now in respect to everybody else. I would say that you could argue Louisiana and Georgia are 3 and 4, and they can flip-flop depending on who you're talking to. Louisiana had a 5-year head start over Georgia, and Louisiana also qualifies productions at a lower threshold of $250,000 versus Georgia's entry at $500,000. Strategically, our tax credits are similar, where we give 30%. Louisiana gives 30% for labor. For local labor, they actually give a 5% boost. And then Louisiana being what Louisiana is people rush to say that they're living in Louisiana when, in fact, they don't. So they actually qualify a lot more people that are not actual residents than we do in Georgia. We sort of play by the book here.
You know, one other area, and it's infrastructure related and as well as talent related, and that is post-production. I want to give a tip of the hat to our post-production facilities. One in particular, I know Crawford Communications,
sure.
who's sort of been the standard for 30 or more years, and they deserve a lot of credit.
They really do. They're the largest post-production house east of the Mississippi and south of New York. And they're comparable with the Post Group or Broadway Video in New York or anyone like that, and they're just as good.
And I want to also give credit. I recently saw you on a panel, and there are other dimensions along with the work of Crawford Studios. There are some attorneys involved in supporting the growth of the industry. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to a studio like Pinewood opening up facilities in the metro region, that doesn't just happen. They didn't just notice that we were favorable environment with multiple dimensions. People got involved proactively.
I know several of them. Yeah,
you are aware of some of what went on behind the scenes. Share with us a little bit of what goes on to turn the head of a studio, get them engaged and wanting to take a close look at a region like this.
Well, knowing that we needed to grow and we needed to have more international stability. And one particular attorney, Steven Weisenecker, who is an entertainment attorney in Georgia and helped Legendary Films get started and has a number of Los Angeles clients he's affiliated and his firm are affiliated with, he got the notion, because he had a client, no secret now, it's the Chick-fil-A family, the Cathys, got involved, and they're the ones who own that property, and they had interest in developing this as a new business adventure, and so they approached Steve, and Steve said, yeah, we can do that. They got together with CPA groups. Now, there's a company, Fraser Dieter, here, and David Dieter, one of the principal partners. And Steve got on a plane and flew to England and said, we think we've got something for you. Now, that becomes an extension of the Georgia Department of Economic Development, so they all become aware of what's going on. And Georgia's being very aggressive just in general. Forget this business. But they're aggressive in general for all types of corporate ventures here in the state. And we have naturally a very supportive culture tax-wise for corporations. Now, throw on top of that this new scenario for entertainment production, and now you've got a catalyst for explosive growth. So those two people proactively took the stand, went to London, did the meetings, brought the people here. They looked at the business plan and went into partnership with the Cathys.
You know, and I don't want to be remiss and overlook the Tyler Perry Studios. You know,
sure.
Tyler Perry himself deserves credit for making this his home base and bringing in millions of dollars.
Well, he has his own studio as well.
Right.
And he's converted and built his own sound stages. He does 100% of his product is generated by him and runs through his studio. Turner Studios does the same thing. So if you had Turner Studios, Tyler Perry Studios, that's five significant studio presences, although that's not a word. It's one of those things where that became the seed. You talked briefly about what happened in North Carolina. They've had business for a long time, but they didn't develop the infrastructure beyond Ewe Screen Gems, which was formerly De Laurentiis Studios back in the 80s. And nothing really changed on their landscape. They didn't get the growth of personnel and crew the same way we did. The same can actually be said about Louisiana. They had a little bit of stage building, but they're really converting warehouses. And those aren't functional sound stages.
You know, Rick, we need part two, part three, and possibly we need to get you in here to give us updates quarterly on the industry in the state of Georgia.
Happy to do it.
We're really pleased that you took the time to come on to the Business Hour. And you deserve a lot of credit personally for the role that you've played in this very, very valuable really cool industry segment. We've been here with Rick Raitz. We've been talking about the film industry, the entertainment industry, his own personal background as an actor, writer, producer, composer, and his role in helping the industry grow. You've been listening to the Business Hour here at Radio Sandy Springs on Fridays from 10 to 11 a.m. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on the radio next week.